Sorry, I missed that. Are we live?
We are live tonight.
All right. Sounds good. So do we have a quorum? One. Wait, do we have a quorum? One. Two.
There's five
three.
Of them. Erica. You have a quorum.
A four. Okay. All right, then, call to order City of Hood River Planning Commission meeting for Monday, February 1st. It is 5:32.
Hey, gang.
Quorum of the Planning Commission is available. Over to you, Planning Director, for your update. Hey, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have an update for anything other than tonight's single agenda matter, which is the missing middle housing code. We're looking for your recommendation tonight on a code that was presented to you a couple of weeks ago. I've taken the code and made some refinements. It includes the full pagination as well as all the internal divisions for numbers that you can refer to. Discuss some of these issues with City Council and tried to incorporate what I saw as recommendations from Planning Commission for revisions or at least things to consider in the code. I have some exhibits in the code itself I can walk through, but that'll be in the first matter. So nothing
other. Okay. Is there an update for 2 weeks from now? Is there a meeting that day? What do you think will be happening that day?
I don't have anything scheduled right now.
Because that's on a Monday and we would move it to a Tuesday if we were going to have the meeting.
Yeah. I have nothing scheduled. We don't have any quasi-judicial requests that would be coming through. So we should be able to push that and then come back in maybe the second meeting if we have any QJR issues, quasi-judicial.
Okay. All right. And then at the end of the meeting today, we're going to have approval of the meeting's minutes. So there's several meeting minutes to be taken care of. Okay. Any questions on the updates?
I was just going to say, I'm curious what City Council had to say about the work we've done so far, but I don't know if that would come now or when Dustin does his presentation or.
There are certain parts I'd be happy to highlight in some of the issues. I've left some highlights in there and some underlines as cues regarding feedback that I've received from City Council, from builders, from you. And I tried to highlight any changes or kind of major pivot points that I felt like were worth pausing for. So as I go through it, I'll take a pause at some key places that I'm guessing you're going to want to talk about, or certain places that that I'd like you to fill in terms of recommendations so far. So.
Okay, perfect, thank you.
Okay, so you'll present. Are we gonna take some input from the audience? I see we have four people online after you do that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to walk through it if you wanna take testimony first. I'm open to the order. Usually I make a presentation, but I was hoping maybe you have some talking points. So I'd be happy to go through the code or first and allow you to allow them to weigh in afterwards.
Let's do that. Let's walk through. You've got some highlighted areas you want some feedback on, and then we can take testimony after we've gone through that.
Great.
Okay.
Okay. Hopefully I share a screen here and I have some documents to walk you through.
Hi, Megan. Welcome to the call.
One second. Maybe this document's going to work. Okay.
Right, Miss Middle Housing.
Excellent. So this was in your packet from last week and a couple of weeks prior. Again, it's now a paginated document with revisions that are up to date. The document really has, as it did last, 7 sections. The first 6 of them relate to some of the background purpose statements. How does the document fit with other regulations in the code? What happens when we have exceptions? It discusses opportunities for land divisions, some procedural statements there, and then gets right into the development standards themselves. Those are organized by topic, which are broken down here for you. This is kind of some of the main subject matter areas, and I think I got them all now included on one page. So we'll kind of go through these one by one as they appear in the code. I'll probably, for those that are less, have had less changes, I'll probably take less time with them and just give you a summary overview. But at any time, please feel free to stop and ask for clarification. This now has, and had before, some definitions. This is an important section because when we start to discuss how do you measure things, what do certain words mean, we don't always take for granted that they have the plain meaning. So if they have some special meaning or special standards, this provides an opportunity to look at and look into how we're, like, such as floor area. No one is going to really measure floor area the same way. This section of the code has a very specific discussion on what does floor area mean in terms of this code. Refers to building height and refers you to section K. This is going to be a section that we've talked about before. This is also a section that got a lot of attention from the building community as well as city council because it has a direct impact on how much you can build on a lot. We also have some unique definitions for some of our duplex or 2-unit and 3-unit configurations. Added to this section is a 4-unit configuration, which prior to this version of the code was not included. We didn't do any prototypes for that, that configuration. It was left to 4 or more units would be discussed in terms of a cottage housing format. Part of the reason was as you get into more units into a single structure, the massing becomes increased. And so that was a configuration that was not included initially in this. It's not staff's recommendation, but we heard interest and feedback to have it at least considered and deliberated. So it appears in the definition section itself. Our purpose statement is typically something that you will see in codes. Why are we doing this code? What is the opportunity? What are the goals? It's really kind of a high level, lofty standard, but should help frame some of the standards below. Our relationships to other codes, this code where it conflicts with other pieces of the code will prevail. That's an important way to try to reconcile any differences we have in our codes. Land division, this code does allow a land division to occur within these developments and prescribes an expedited land division process. It also provides the opportunity for an applicant, if they wish, to go through the standard discretionary process, which is just a provision opportunity. They're not forced to go through an expedited land division. They could go through the non-expedited land division. The last highlighted piece here has to do with covenants and restrictions. Heard back from some of our development community. They have concerns about small HOAs being put in place, being onerous and expensive for 2-unit, 3-unit, or essentially smaller HOAs. I appreciate that. I do not have a recommendation on how we would handle common areas and common problems. So the reason why this appears in the code is because I have every expectation we are going to have common provisions, common driveways, common stormwater features, common landscaping. This provides, and in some instances, common walls. this is in to help provide an opportunity for residents, future residents, to self-police or have self-remedies to resolve disputes and lay down common expectations with their neighbors, and also provides a vehicle for them to address those issues. So where we have common elements, we need to have some assurance, or I recommend some assurance, that we have a vehicle for people who are moving into these areas to be put on notice, that there are common responsibilities and common features. Getting right in the code and right from the front, I put a side-by-side comparison in here. This is not my expectation that this will live in the code, but the reason why it's in this piece in particular is it provides a little bit of perspective from where the code stands now, the first draft that you saw, as well as some of the changes that were made as a reflection of conversation that we had with Planning Commission, as well as some of the recommendations we received by some of the development community, as well as input provided by City Council. The big change in this is if you look from the R1 draft code, which I presented, to the white column, which is revisions to be presented to you, Planning Commission, for feedback, really come in the R2 and R3 standards. There was a request to consider an even more progressive approach to allowing or permitting smaller dwelling units. So as the housing or the middle housing code was initially developed, we separated dwelling units and allowed a greater number of units to be built under the same area, so long as there was a size cap. And you can see that in the light green, where you see one dwelling for every 1500 square feet as the area ratio. In the subsequent column, there's now a provision that talks about units that are under 800 square feet, and an added bonus that now allows them to be built at one for every 1250 square feet for both R2 and R3 zones. It's significant shift when it comes to R2 and R3. Essentially, the current code will allow two dwelling units, the draft code would allow three, and this section would, as drafted, would allow four smaller units for every 5,000 square feet. So you could look at it as two units allowed, three units allowed, or four units allowed, depending on the configuration. It's pretty significant when it comes to the number of dwelling units permitted in an area. So if you have a recommendation on how you feel about the revision to add another really category for smaller units, I'd be happy to take that down and take some feedback from you. Everybody at once.
Well, I guess, should we deliberate here or just ask questions? Because I have some definite commentary from reading the comments, getting an update from the City Council meeting on all of this stuff. So,
yeah, I'd love to take it now.
Should that seem reasonable, Mark?
I think it's perfect while we're on the topic. So it's,
yeah. Begin. I mean, I sent out a list of the 15 things that I had gone through in the code. A couple of my big ones are probably the quadplex one, I think we should have a little discussion on, because there's like from a real estate and financing and a bunch of other perspectives, there's a reason to do those in my book. And then on this particular one, I think that what has been proposed by a couple commenters and the Portland Infill Code is to do something that incentivizes. I think Heather made some great comments, like what happens if you have a 4,900 square foot lot? Can we do some calculation that's based upon something that's not limited to the specific lot size? And I just be interested. And I understood from council that they had, I talked to Kate and she said, yeah, that they had seen Heather's comment and thought that seemed interesting. And we're looking for some code concept to get fleshed out to consider. So I guess that's my comment on this section. Anyone else?
I think the only thing that sort of struck out for me, I mean, I know this is R1 draft code was a couple of weeks ago, but you know, just this idea of, and I'm looking at the R1, 2,500 square foot gets you a dwelling. Two lots, you can put two dwellings on it. You don't really get to three lots, but you know, if you had an oversized R1 lot that was 8,000 square feet, right, you could put three dwellings on it. And it just seemed to me, if you were in a neighborhood that was an R1 neighborhood, and I appreciate there's not that many left in town, all of a sudden you could have three units on that. That seemed to be maybe a surprise. I think the city people, the public would be quite surprised to have that happen next door to them a year from now. I thought that might be worth a discussion point with everyone. I mean, granted, there's some limitation to the size of the unit, which we'll talk about, but overall, it just seemed like a pretty drastic shift from what we have now.
I was also struck by.
Do you have any comment?
I was going to say I noticed, I think it's Greg Crafts, one of his comments was that there's no demand for one bedroom units. And that struck me. I'd really like to get some more conversation around that, because I think what we want to make sure we incentivize developers and builders to build these things, but there has to be a demand for them. Making 800 square feet and less has got to be a single bedroom.
A comment I'll put out to that is that I can't speak specifically for Greg, but I have a fiveplex over on 13th that's right up the hill from Kickstand, and it's all one bedroom units and they're rented all the time. So I think Greg's comment could be related to a purchase unit, a sale unit. And I think we kind of keep getting into mindset of we're building these for one or we're building these for the other, but certainly, and I asked the planning staff to send out a duplex that had got built by Joel Knutson that has, you know, their one bedroom units. He said he's renting them for 1,300 or 1,400 a month. And they were like, as soon as he was done, had a list and could rent more of them. So I think Greg's comment might be specifically related to the sales side of it, but there's tons of one bedroom demand in the rental side.
All right, so from this, if we don't have any more discussion right now, I'll keep moving.
Yeah, one question back, Dustin, back to Mark's comment. He was expressing the thought that in the R1 zone, we could get to three or more units on a lot.
Well, if it was an oversized lot at 8,000 or 7,500, basically.
Do you agree with that comment based upon your understanding of the code set, Dustin?
Yeah, it's one dwelling for every 2,500, right? Okay. So it's not necessarily, that would be a two on a standard 7,000. If you had an oversized lot, you could end up doing upwards of, for say for a cottage, if you had a 15,000 square foot lot, you could end up with six.
Okay.
So it scales, there is a ceiling, and I included a side-by-side comparison for you in your packet as well. And I have that up here. I could go through that as well.
And what's the status at the state level for allowing in urban areas, duplex, triplex, quad on, or what is it on any lot inside an urban boundary?
For cities, House Bill 2001 and the subsequent OAR from 660-40, I believe, will require cities over 10,000 to allow a duplex on any lot. And then cities between 10,000 and 25,000 or in the metro area will end up with a quad in many ways, quads on corners. But for a city such as Hood River, and right now there's nothing required. Within 5 to 10 years, depending on how we grow, and we pass 10,000 people, this would, if the law stands, would require the city to allow a duplex on any lot that allows a single family home. And that would be mandatory.
Okay, thank you.
So when I first, just a side note, when I first developed some of these concepts, I asked city council whether they wanted to contemplate that, whether the city as a city that will become possibly 10,000 people in the not so distant future, would they want us to consider and allow the duplex provision, even though it's not mandatory now, that it would be mandatory. So they did indicate at that time that they wanted us to look at the duplex aspect of 2001, rather than wait for us to become 10,000 and become mandatory. So, moving along, these are the configurations that the units can come in. This was based upon prototypes. They initially included the 2-unit configuration, attached or detached, 3 units attached or detached, and then the introduction of the 4-unit, which was initially not submitted in the original draft, and then cottage cluster. So part of the issue with the 4-unit is it starts to overlap our definition of multifamily in the city. Into the setback perimeter buffer yard. When we talked last, there was an indication in movement that we would use landscape area rather than a lot coverage area or some other metric to determine how much open space or not built space was included. So based upon that, you're gonna see more intentional discussions in the setback and perimeter yards and landscaping. These numbers and the measurements and distance basically all follow the setbacks as set today in the underlying zones, with the exception of the rear buffer yard and the alley buffer yard, which was something that anticipates a greater use and reliance on rear yard access, side yard access. So there's some unique provisions here that allow a greater latitude in these areas. If we want to encourage alley use, direct in alley parking, it's going to be pretty difficult to require some landscaping between the alley and the area that you're trying to take access from. So there's some specific provisions that are set aside in here to address that scenario.
But hey, Dustin.
Yeah.
Do you have like a diagram that shows like where all these things are? Like I was trying to figure out what is an interior side buffer yard.
That's a side yard. That's not on side yard, not on the street. Side yard, not street side yard.
Okay. So on a corner lot, you would only have one of these.
Yep.
And in a standard single frontage lot, you would have 2 of them.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Just that's the interior. So that's the difference between public. We just call it public street yard buffer inside. So interior side.
Got it.
Side.
Makes sense.
These two, same scenario, garage setback is 20 feet. Garage buffer yard from the alley is actually less than it is now, but still requiring a 5-foot setback. Lot coverage, I've stricken based on our last conversation. Public street dedications, this is essentially a placeholder that says you got to comply with the street standards. I don't want there to leave or undergrounding of utilities. So no confusion that just because we're following this code that all of a sudden this grants some approval of departure from our current street standard. I highlighted the street connectivity because that was raised as an issue. This is a direct excerpt from our subdivision code. The requirement comes when we have subdivisions, we want to create walkable blocks or more manageable block size. We don't end up with really long street frontages without breaks. So that was imported into this code with the expectation that these would also in many ways be a subdivision. Given the size restrictions on a lot of these, meaning the number of units and the infill, the likelihood that this will be applied or be triggered is pretty small. But it's in there just in case we do end up with the circumstance where we need to consider the block length. Street frontage improvements, basically a reiteration of sidewalk and street trees. These are pretty important standards, especially, again, now we're getting into some narrower landscape provisions, putting the emphasis on this, which is a pretty important design standard for these type of developments is included. The frontage requirement is waived here with the expectation that we will see not only on the street, but lots built off the street, such as our a townhouse configuration now, as well as PUDs. The requirements for everyone to be served off public sewer, individual water and sewer services. Parking, and I'll take a pause at parking. This was a spirited conversation currently in the code as shown below. Each of these units will require two parking spaces. The draft code that came back to you included one space, which is still included in the code. And I know there was some discussion that was raised by certain members. They wanted to make sure that this received some attention and deliberation as well. So that's the number of units. The piece that I've highlighted here is in regards to parking in the perimeter setback not being allowed. So that's, again, another design standard that is pretty, it's significant. It's significant in terms of where we store cars and how these developments look.
Justin, can I comment on this? Or how is this, meeting working? I'm sorry I was late. Are we deliberating aspects of this later or are we commenting on this now?
Yeah, I think I'm looking for comments right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can deliberate later too, as we go through it.
All right. Regarding number four, the one bicycle storage space, could we specify covered? Or how does everybody feel about that one?
Isn't that what the garage is for? No, I'm kidding. I mean, it's like, I don't think I'd leave my bike out inside, especially a new e-bike. So I sort of feel like it's kind of like the curb cut discussion. We create this thing on the outside. Nobody uses it because they put their bike in the garage.
I don't think.
Erica?
I don't think we should. These small housing developments, I don't think we should require covered bike parking. It might end up becoming the trash repository or you never know.
Okay. That's a covered sheltered spot is a make or break for many people without cars that want big cargo bikes. And in fourplexes and above, it's really efficient to just build one covered storage facility for like six bikes or eight bikes. It's pretty economical. And the other comment I want to make about parking is in our last two meetings, the first meeting that we had of the year, Sacramento City Council voted 9-0 unanimous to eliminate parking minimums. And then the following Our last meeting, Berkeley City Council met and voted unanimously 9-0 to eliminate parking minimums. And last year, a city more our size, Hudson, New York, I don't know if how many of you have been there, but it is very much like Hood River. Its population 6,700, very arts and ag centric, and they just voted last year to eliminate parking minimums. And I just want to read a quote from the mayor of Berkeley when they deliberated. He says, "The parking changes approved this week addresses two major issues facing our city, climate change and housing costs." He goes on to say, "Requiring less parking in new projects decreases the cost of the construction and also addresses the reality that people are opting to use other forms of transportation and moving away from a car-centered society." I don't feel like we are doing enough by going from 2-1, especially for fourplexes and under. And it's a Tina touched on this last meeting. It's a major equity issue for both low income and people with disabilities. I just read that 35% of people with disabilities do not drive. And so they are forced to pay more for their housing, even though they are not bringing a car. This issue is just a big, it's a major equity issue, and we're falling a little bit behind on what's happening nationally.
Yeah, you have recommendations from the Home Builders Association for 0.5, I think, to 0.75. That was what came from the HBA of Portland at your last meeting. They sent that to me afterwards, so I didn't have it before. They sent it directly to you. I know, and I believe Amy mentioned as well in her notes to me that she would be supportive of 0.5 to 0.75. But that's a matter of discussion and recommendation for you all.
So how does that work? Say it's like a fourplex, and they have to require two parking spaces. That means that two of the units could sell or be rented without having to pay for parking, and two of the units would be sold or rented with parking. Am I right?
Yeah, the parking is not, it's just a number. So if you had a unit, and I have an expectation that you'll most likely, if they're not built with garages, they'll have some common space or common set aside. There's nothing that requires the unit to be sold with the parking space. That's the decoupled. So you may have someone who has a larger unit, a 1500 square foot, they want two spaces. You may have someone with an 800 square foot that doesn't want anything. They're not tied to the units themselves as written this way. There's just a number. So you could average. So
it's up to the developer to decide, right? I mean, wouldn't they could sell it that way.
Right. We're just looking at the total number of units to parking spaces, not coupling them together.
Yeah. It seems to me that this is a big piece of what we're after, is we are looking at writing this whole new section of code to do something that currently we can't do. Right. And so to just kind of fall back on some of our established parameters doesn't really make much sense. I mean, the idea is to, let's be a little bold and be progressive and try to get the kind of housing that we don't currently have. And I think a big piece of that is dialing back this parking requirement we could talk about this for an hour, but I mean, for a lot of reasons, I think we need to dial it back. And a big one of those is just to give the developers more flexibility. I mean, look, we already had a debate about, you know, is there a market for one bedroom units? I mean, how do we not know that there isn't a great market for no parking units? We don't know because we've never let the market decide. So I feel like if we eliminate the parking requirement, let developers decide, you know, maybe they want to do a mix where, you know, certain units have a little garage or a parking, you know, pad or whatever, and others don't. And that's how they can maximize the marketability of their units. And as Megan points out, you know, and as I mentioned last week, I mean, you know, we really need to kind of consider the fact that just because for the last 50 years, everybody has demanded having, you know, space for their cars, that's not going to be true 50 years from now or 5 years from now. And so I really think that this is our time for this one little housing, housing code to let's be a little bolder. And I say, give the developers maximum flexibility. Why wouldn't we? Let them decide. They don't want to build stuff that no one's going to buy. So if they think parking's important, then they'll figure out a way to get some parking in there. But why are we baking it into the code? It doesn't seem to work for what we're trying to accomplish here.
There's three of you. Sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, this was my comment way back at the beginning when I had a comment on something. I feel like what we need to do is let Dustin get through this, take testimony, go into deliberations, and then have an organized mechanism that we talk about every one of these things, and then take some votes on some items.
Okay.
Does that make sense, Mark?
Yeah, that does.
We've got some opinions, and we're not doing anything about them, I guess. So.
All right, we'll move on to access and circulation. This goes back to limiting the number of curb cuts as measured at the property line and how much your front yard as well as the site can allow for access. This also mandates access through the alley if you do have alley access, really promoting that once again, allowing one single driveway approach per building site frontage. Is a key consideration. And then one item that we did hear back from the development community, which I think I included a graphic here, was a concern that some of the prototypes didn't have the radius that allowed some turnarounds on site. So within that, I included a criteria that talked about, and this is from ITE and some turning templates for passenger vehicles that would require a minimum inside a 10-foot turning radius and outside 18-foot turning radius, which looks something like the candy cane that you have here. And I could dial that up. And then a turnaround provision.
Could you explain that thing on the right? Because I couldn't read it, and it seemed like it was upside down or backwards. Mirrored.
The
whole graphic was, yeah. I mean, both of those. I was trying to figure out what you were trying to tell us.
Oh, the opportunity to have a turnaround. If you wanted to have a turnaround, it would have the same type of configuration.
Got it. Okay. It have radius requirements on turnarounds.
Right. 10-foot. And again, it would be the same 10-foot inside, 18-foot outside, which is really what, again, if you have a large vehicle, it's going to be a little more challenging to do that. But it's really in response to trying to design in, if you have internal parking to allow people to actually with enough space to turn around. That was developer feedback. This section, we're now into landscaping, stormwater, and LID. The first three sections talk about LID as a recommendation. We want to encourage, but not, this does not require the use of low impact development, but it provides some of the recommendations and the hallmarks of low impact development, the use of vegetated swales, limiting impervious surfaces. Really, it's intended to as an encouragement. These are going to be infill sites, and they will be challenging to do. Landscaping, this has been developed quite a bit, really as a result of moving away from our maximum coverage area to a minimum landscape standard. Included is, a clip from the side-by-side comparison of where we start with the with our current code, what was drafted, and where we've ended up in some of the recommendations that are coming to you tonight. The look of of this and some of the issues that were raised. I have another graphic for this if you want to, once we dig into it. The moving from an R1, which was essentially 48% max, 40% standard coverage to essentially what would be a 70% coverage or 30% landscaping standard, all the way to R3 and C1, which is really a pretty small departure, where we have, you know, upwards of 63% permeable area now to about 70%. It's only about a 7% bounce in that area. And I have a side-by-side as well as a graphic we can look at. We heard some concern about the amount of change, especially in R1, of what that could look like. So I can show you in graphics what that change would be. We pull up, this is a currently what an R1 lot, the setbacks would require. This is about 31% shown in green. Here, the depiction here shows essentially what is built, the amount of area that would be built or allowed to be covered today in this dark black. And this would be essentially the balance of the site. The picture next to it would be the standard 31% set aside for setbacks. This includes if you wanted to go to 35%, you would add that much area, and 40% would be both blocks included. So that's the difference of a 30% site essentially and a 40% in R1.
Could you, so to clarify that, are you going to show us a different, like R2 or something?
Yeah, I'll show you what R2 looks like as well. Okay. So this is the R2 look right now. The setbacks in R2 are about 33% plus or minus landscape area, omitting the driveway. This would be an R2 lot that would have 40%. So the exterior coverage plus this area would essentially be a 40% landscape area on a typical R2 lot. And then, as I mentioned, R3 is essentially 63% now. This would be a 69% coverage on an R3 lot. So pretty minimum, a 7% difference now. I didn't depict that one. This is what, and when we talk about, I can go back to that. This is what this, this is an R1 configuration, essentially what the floor area or the coverage area and what a 28 foot and 38 foot kind of massing would be. And this is essentially a 30% coverage, 35% coverage, 40% coverage. And then R2, excuse me, this is essentially what an R2 looks like in mathematical area. A 33% coverage, this is a 40% coverage amount. This is a housing unit that would be 20 feet to the eave, 25%, 25 feet to the peak, 28 feet to this ridge, 38 feet to the upper portion. You know, I'll save these for some of our height conversations. So within here, you have the recommended, the amount that I heard before, 30%. And I have alternates that have been included in here that would consider the upsizing or the amount that would change for landscaping. Within the landscaping schedule, using those areas, those setbacks included in this are planting rates, mathematical planting rates that would are intended to provide some coverage amounts of living material as well as trees and shrubs to serve as a buffer. Currently, there are no landscape standards in this area. They only are required to be not built with parking and or driveways or houses.
So could you explain this? I was getting a little confused, or maybe I thought about this in two different ways. I'm thinking that every particular prescribed distance, there has to be something in the ground. I was like, that sounds pretty prescriptive. We're just saying in some particular area, there needs to be this much and it can be grouped or organized from a design perspective.
Yeah, I think I'm just looking for a number. So it okay. doesn't mean it's like, I don't think it's intended to be, you know, a sentinel, you know, every 5 feet there's a plant. I think that would be the number of plants. So if they were grouped in plant beds or built around features, I'm just looking to check off a number. So it takes some of the artistry out of it and boils it down to mathematics. So again, referring to the same distance, setback, alley buffer, basically nothing again in the alley area, and credits for existing trees preserved. So the idea, if you did preserve a tree on site, we would credit back, much like we do for street trees. Note here, all the open space designations, all the common private open space have been omitted. This makes a single statement, pedestrian access shall be provided to the units via path. This changes the idea that you would be able to or be forced to walk to your unit through a common driveway. It really emphasizes the idea of pedestrian first design and the human scale of this development.
Can I jump in with one question before we leave this landscape stuff? Mm-hmm. So when we're calculating this 30%, could you go back and make sure we understand how that would be measured and what contributes to it? Meaning,
if you were,
what I mean, is there a requirement the thing is green? Does it have to be a living material in that area? Is it, it can't be hardscaped, or like, what's the definition of this? How are you going to look and add up this? Let's say we pick 40%. What are you going to go to do to add it all up?
Well, and if you had that path, like on this particular drawing, if you had the 5 foot setbacks on the side yard and you want a 4 foot path, can you put a 4 foot path down that side yard and that's called open space? Or as Bill's saying, is it, if it's hardscape, it counts as one thing. If it's bark mulch, it's something else, right? So what would we do with that?
Yeah, so in the perimeter plantings, that's part of the rate, is it intends to have a certain amount of coverage that occurs. If you're gonna require one tree every 30 feet, you end up with a certain amount of coverage. Five shrubs per every 30 feet, you end up with a certain amount of coverage. We could be more specific on what does or does not include landscaping or hardscape. The walkway is limited from the side yard, so you wouldn't be able to just side yard or essentially sidewalk your side yard. There is a permitted encroachment that we'll get to that allows a certain amount of that sidewalk to occur within that landscape. But you would have the opportunity, it's stated, I believe it's 2 feet would allow to be encroached, allows an encroachment. But you could definitely specify, do sidewalks count hardscape, decorative hardscape count as landscape or not. Mm-hmm. In this instance, it is basically regulated by, this is what is in the side yard setback.
Could you, nope. Just because we're asking questions right now and not deliberating, could you take us back up to that landscape code section and show us where we are getting the definition of what it is? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it doesn't define what landscape is. It basically says you're going to end up with a 10-foot yard, and you're going to end up with in that yard,
okay,
these trees and these trees.
Well, I guess where I'm going is if we decide to, you know, all the setbacks are X, but if we decide to up that buffer from 30% to 40% or something, we're going to have an extra 10%. And I'm just trying to figure out, like, what could it be? Or what does it need to be to meet that additional requirement? And so what you're saying so far is we don't have any definitions around what that would need to be if we increase the requirement.
Yeah, if you increased it, you could definitely count a hardscape or decorative hardscape, or you could say it needs to be living material.
Okay.
But right now, just as it's written, is the buffers cover the 30%.
Got it.
Moving from that, we're into dwelling area size restrictions. And this is where that definition of floor area comes into play. Initially, we did not we're not considering a ceiling or a hard ceiling. We would back into them. But based on some of the changes in the buildable area, the amount that we're looking at by way of landscaping, some of the discussions around ceiling height, the amount of developable area really started to warrant a development ceiling. Otherwise, you would end up with full units or could end up with full-size units on these lots. So that's why this was introduced. This reflects the definition from above on how do you get to this square footage, which is an important item to have because we will discuss it when it comes to how do you calculate what is this square footage and what counts and what doesn't count. The standard here that really provides people notice that you may not be able to increase the size of your dwelling unit once you buy it. That's an important disclosure for buyers who buy something at 1500 square feet, if that's the number, and with the expectation to increase, that is something that we don't want to make a surprise to future property owners. Continuing on, the building orientation and separation, two key features here, facing the streets, not turning your back on the public domain, as well as keeping a 10-foot separation between detached structures. Now down to building height. This is the way the code is drafted based upon the graphics now, and I know you all will want to discuss it. As described in the previous definition, it makes mention of this average grade calculation. This is something that the current code does not use now. We don't have an average grade. We use from essentially on sites that have less than 10 feet of slope, we're measuring 28 feet from the upper portion or within 5 feet of this wall. For sites that have more than 10 feet, we're measuring 10 feet above the lowest portion and 28 feet from there. And that's from original grade. This takes into account, it's mentioned as finished grade, with the anticipation we're gonna see multiple units on a smaller site. Leaving it as pre-development grade becomes really difficult to try to balance stormwater, try to balance driveways, and make some of these buildings fit together. That's why the finished grade calculation comes in. Also, our current code is just difficult to administer and results in different outcomes, variability in outcomes. This is a look for a pitched roof standard being 25 feet, intended to allow two stories of development and provide a height benefit for a pitched roof configuration. So the shed structure, again, anticipated to allow for two-story development, but now becoming increasingly restrictive at the roof height. And flat roof configuration, 20 feet, two-story look, and increasingly restrictive at the height. And we can go back and deliberate that. Architectural features. I think we heard from you that the trim was not an ideal feature. I did hear somebody mention 1.5 inch, but that has been eliminated. This was a request. Wall elevations that exceed 20 feet in height at any point shall include a wall break or plane break at least 2 feet in depth and 6 feet wide. This was mentioned, not necessarily 6 feet, but mentioned by our development community on the impacts of tall walls and their overall massing, the intent to break up those elevations and provide a little relief. This goes back to the front porch standard. requirements for all houses to have a front porch. This is really back to engaging the public domain, providing some pedestrian scale and some orientation of the units themselves. 6 feet by 60 are the two standards. I eliminated the entire area the front porch must be covered and put the covered section of the porch should be 60 feet. So just in case somebody wanted to do a larger porch, they didn't all of a sudden get forced into covering something more than what they would do. So we just left it at a minimum. Here's the amount that you would have to cover. If you wanted to do more, you're not going to be forced into a different design standard. This piece, the front porch, shall be at least 50% of the total elevation. That was raised as a constraint, concern that if you had a front-loaded garage, you would end up with a 12-foot porch and some challenges to orientation. There's a reason why I highlighted it, just as a note. This is an added list of permitted obstructions. We had a couple of these in the last iteration, but I wanted to be real clear about what is and what is not permitted. Currently now in the code, we have a similar item category, which has resulted in some confusion and difficulty. This is a specific list of items that is allowed in the yard and setback areas. So we've gone from a similar item list, which can be discretionary, which we need to avoid, to a very deliberate list of known quantities here. And I think this is we got a couple more to go. Fences requiring or limiting fence height along the exterior of the property to be 4 feet. This is gonna work against somebody putting a 6 foot tall fence in a development that is supposed to be forward facing. It also limits some 6 foot fences to be installed within the interior of the property, separating at that time what was considered to be common spaces. This is one of the catch-all features that talks about accessory dwelling units, accessory buildings, existing units that could possibly be built into or expanded to a middle housing. We may have some single family homes out there that would be eligible to have other development built around it. Rather than a full scrape off and infill, there is an opportunity to have some of these things knit within the existing building stock to save an existing home. This provides that opportunity right here. And it's written into how that would be administered. There's still a limit on ADUs within this code. Because the code really starts to contemplate units that are 800 square feet and less and adds a density to that, this, there's really, those start falling in line with what could be an ADU. So it still doesn't include an ADU provision on here. It already contemplates smaller units. And then in this location, there's a prohibition on transient, short-term, hosted home, shore, or vacation rental. That was my add on here. Welcome, looking for recommendation from Planning Commission on STRs.
Okay.
And that's the code. That's all the pieces. I can stop the share.
Okie dokie. Well, no, why don't you keep the share going? Oh, well, actually, yeah. Let's stop the share. Shall we contemplate some comments from the public? I see we have four people on.
Yes.
If anyone you want, like to speak, go ahead and raise your hand. Commissioner Irving, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I think now would be a great time for public comment.
Yep.
John, could you remind us? Oh, okay. Remind us how to raise your hand.
Sure. Everyone here looks to be connected by a computer, so there will be a raise hand button on your screen.
Thank you,
computer. All right. Heather, you should be on. Unmute yourself and then go ahead. We still don't hear you. Oh, here we go.
Okay, good. Took a couple pushes of unmute to work.
No worries. Okay, we can hear you now.
So I'm Heather Staten from Thrive Hood River, and I've got a couple of comments. I think the code is really looking very good. There's a few things that we think should be tweaked a little, and I wanted to start with something that you were talking about, Mark, about how big of change it might feel like in the R1 zone. And I want to preface this by 2,500 square feet is what, or allowing a duplex, which is essentially creating two 2,500 square foot lots, is something that every medium-sized city in Oregon has to do now because of House Bill 2001. So it's a very common thing. The other thing is that currently we allow PUDs in the R1 zone, and the Dana Lane PUD that's near you is R1, and all of the lots are 2,000 square feet or less. So it's already something through a different mechanism than that can already occur in the R1 zone. There are some parts of this code which, even with duplexes, which is really not much of a stretch in R1, that are such good design standards in terms of the way things interact with the street and the rest of the neighborhood, that I think that you're going to find that these fit right into R1 neighborhoods and aren't particularly disruptive. I did want to suggest you guys maybe look at a floor area ratio instead of the maximum unit area ratio to decide how many units can be on an R2 or R3 lot. I think there are just going to be some situations where you've got a strangely sized lot where if you used a FAR instead of the maximum unit area ratio, you could get an extra unit. Let me see what else I had. And I continue to agree that the market is good at deciding how much housing is needed, that builders, if they think that it's going to be important to sell their projects that parking is included, they'll do that. And so I would encourage you to remove parking, a parking minimum. And I think that's all I've got.
All right. Thanks, Heather. Thanks. Anybody else?
Could I ask Heather if she has any comments on the open space percent right now? 30, the pictures we saw?
You know, I did ask the Home Builders Association what they thought about it, because I don't really have a clear conception myself of what a reasonable coverage is. And they thought 25% was a better percentage to achieve what the city is hoping to achieve, which I think really is about incentivizing more smaller units that are going to be priced more cheaply. Yeah. And also, I hope you guys all got the thing that I sent earlier today about fourplexes, because I've heard again and again that those are a really good and important unit type to include in this code.
Right. Yeah, we got that. I believe everyone got that.
Awesome. Cool.
Okay, anybody else want to provide the comments? Going once, going twice. All right.
Be the first meeting that Linda ever went to and didn't comment. Is there?
Yeah, maybe she can't find the raised hand button.
May I ask a question about one of the comment letters we got? Because I wasn't able to open it from Nancy Roach. What was the synopsis?
Was this something that was sent today or with your packet?
I
think it came fairly recently.
I had asked to get the city council comments, and Nancy had sent comments in that. I don't know. I remember reading that, but I'm not sure if that's the one you're talking about.
I got
Nancy Roach comments came on Friday.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't. The only thing I have was sent before that. I don't have anything. Oh, Linda did raise her hand too, by the way.
Okay. We could promote Linda. Speak, talking. Okay, Linda, if you can come off mute, you can make your comment.
Mark, are you?
We hear.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, your sound might be cutting in and out. I'm not sure that the cell phone or the coverage is the best, but go ahead.
Okay, let me turn it up. Let me.
Okay, no, you're good. That's good.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah, I'm very unhappy with this whole process. So, but I'm late to the gate. So I realize that. First of all, we're far away from a 25,000 person population here in Hood River, which is when this House Bill 2001 becomes effective. I realize at a 10,000 population, we are required to allow duplexes in all zones. I feel like this is really beyond even Planning Commission, goes to City Council. It is an enormous policy change. And I know Heather knows that for sure. I've worked with her for years. And I'm sure most of you also realize that. It is a huge, huge policy change. And I almost wonder, you know, it's COVID time, we can't meet anymore and, you know, chat. I almost wonder if there's some way that we could get much more input from our community on it before we go ahead with this. I am very concerned that it's just too much. I mean, going up to a 30% coverage for landscaping, no parking, all sorts of things. I totally understand the need for cheaper housing, but I'm just really concerned that this is way too much. It's an overstretch. And I don't want to just pour water on it, but I'm really concerned about parking. I just went up on my way back from my walk this afternoon. I went up on 29th and 30th to see the Mike Kettler duplexes and my kids' duplexes that have been put up there and how that's affected parking. And basically, there were 18 cars parking on the street. There were also cars parking in the driveways. We can ideally think, yes, everybody's going to give up their car. But in truth, I mean, I live with 34 units here, and most of the people here have more than one car, and it is a problem. And they don't have parking within their area. And I want to correct Heather on one thing. Most, like my unit has 2,600 square feet. I'm on a 2,600 square foot area of land. I don't have a garage. I'm the only house that doesn't have a garage here in Dana Lane. But the parking situation here has always been a problem. It is a problem. People are parking on streets where they're not supposed to be. But we haven't enforced it. The HOA has not enforced it very well. And so there's overflow to 30th, but I could really see it up at the end of the street on 29th and 30th. And even worse than here. So, but the most important thing for me is, I think one of the things that's really important is we keep saying how we're concerned about climate change. You know, the city council has said, yes, they want to do things about climate change. And I'm so concerned with the coverage on the lots in this plan to have, you know, so little soil actually getting wet because of roofs and garage and parking spaces and garages. But I also am concerned because when I read this zone, it looks to me that you are supposed to park your car in a garage, not on the area in front of it. And but maybe I'm reading it wrong. Dustin, you may be able to fill me on that. But I really feel that this zone is going too far. I may be, on a minority, And but I really feel it would be a good idea to get it out to more people. Like maybe wait half a year when we can have like a town hall meeting and show people what is in the plans, and maybe everybody will embrace it. I don't know, but I really feel that it is too far. And I also, Dustin, there's no real definition of middle housing. I think maybe there needs to be an addition of that. And I'm also concerned about CCNRs. I'm in an HOA now. I'm on the board of it, and they basically don't have a lot of, at least mine does not have a lot of force in terms of how what we can demand from the people that are owners here. I just see all sorts of, you know, issues. But I do think we need to have parking because everybody loves their cars. And here in the 34 units here, many people don't just have two cars, they have three. They have their Sprinter vans or whatever they carry or pickup. People love their cars. And I wish it wasn't so, Megan, but it's true. And so anyway, I am very concerned about this, and also that I think it's great to be ahead of the demand or ahead of, you know, the program, but I don't know that we can afford in many ways, from climate to the cost of infrastructure, to have such density. I'm really not sure about that. And if somebody wants to live in a dense environment, there are cities that people are moving out of where they can live very densely. And I feel that way. I feel that way in a very emotional way. Anyway, those are some of my comments, and I'm concerned about the cost of this for the town to have this density, the infrastructure cost. And I certainly don't see lowering SDCs to incentivize any of it. If anything, the SDCs need to be the same because they're going to be enormous costs to carry a population in a way that this zone allows. Okay, that's enough for tonight. I'm sorry I went on, but I'm just tearing my hair out over it today. And I just think about it. Think about what are you doing to this town? And the other thing is, where does this middle housing come in? It's not clear. Are there going to be certain zones for middle housing, or it looks like it can go anywhere? And that's not clear to me. Okay, I will get off my rag. I'm sorry, Mark, but I just, yeah, lots of comments.
Thanks, okay. Thanks, Linda Maddox. We also have a hand up from Nancy Roach. Nancy, we can hear you.
You can hear me now, okay. Yes. I'm sorry, Greg and I are, my husband Greg Crafts and I are watching this on the TV, and I couldn't figure out how to unmute it, how to talk on the TV. So, first of all, I did not submit comment. I worked with Greg on his comment. I did submit comment to the last Planning Commission meeting and the City Council meeting. I also think I really applaud what y'all are looking at, because I drive up 4th Street almost every day when I go to the store, something like that. And I see developments on 4th Street that are basically a garage and a wall facing the street, 10 feet from the street, that are allowed and permitted in our existing code. And the building is going to happen no matter if we change the code, if we don't change the code, the building is going to happen. It's happening already. And I think we can all see examples around the city of places that we would like to have tweaked or done very drastically differently. So I think moving forward with this is important. And I also think it's important to remember that middle housing is maybe not for people who have three cars. I have friends who have two cars, they work two jobs, they're basically barely able to hang on here, and they can't afford to buy a house. They're the people I think of when I think of the middle housing. And they have a kid in school here. Those are the people I hold in my heart when during the hours I've spent looking at this and getting feedback from other people. And I really appreciate Also that Dustin obviously has listened to feedback to make these more reality-based as opposed to theory-based. And I have one last comment. I agreed that one bedroom apartments are great. If you build a one bedroom house, I'm not sure that's so useful, right? And that's what Greg's comments were about, the demand for a one bedroom house. And that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Nancy. Okay, so back to us then. I think that's it from the public. So how do we want to go through this? I jotted down a few topic areas that we want to cover. So certainly the parking discussion, the lot coverage discussion, there was a piece on the unit size that we'd like to talk to. And then there's a few others that are rattling around that I think maybe we could kind of do a quick up or down vote whether we wanted to cover them or not. But so I'm thinking about, there's the CC&R discussion, the fourplex discussion, front porch, and STRs. Whether do we want to kind of do a quick upvote, downvote on whether we want to cover those? What do people think? I'm of course saving time for the parking, the lot coverage, and the unit size restrictions as the three main topic areas.
I think a lot of those are worthwhile discussion. I mean, I think we could cover the CC&R one pretty quickly, and I have some commentary on that.
Yeah. Okay. Does that sound like a plan? We'll focus on those three, but if we want to rattle through the other ones just to see if anyone has any comments, okay. If you have any that I missed, yes. You could add them. All right. So CC&R.
Sounds like a plan.
CC&Rs, we'll start there. Bill?
Okay, I have been I come across cases where in my day-to-day job as real estate as well as doing some development where there are common, you know, Dustin raised the concern that in cases where there are common elements that have to be maintained, you got to figure out how they're going to get maintained. And the way that works in the real estate world is basically there's two approaches. You have in small units, small projects, you typically have a common wall agreement or a common maintenance agreement or a shared driveway agreement or something like that. That's a document that outlines responsibilities for maintenance, how costs are going to be shared for maintenance, the frequency of maintenance. And in the event that, you know, someone really needs to go to it, there's some legal recourse in a document like that. However, there's a little bit of is relying upon, you know, good faith cooperation between the neighbors to affect some of those things. You get into cases where you have larger HOAs, and I have formed one and been the president of one, and it is a lot of overhead to set up and do all the documents for an HOA. Operating agreement, bylaws, register with the state. It costs $5,000 or $10,000 per project. You have to have a reserve study for all the common elements. You basically have to typically accrue funds for replacement of common elements. You have to have, you basically need to file taxes annually. You have to have a board of directors. I mean, it seems to me like it's an excessive amount of overhead for something that's of the size that we're talking. And so that's a spot where I think maybe I appreciate the intention the intent of what's trying to be accomplished, but I think maybe we should consider an alternative for the smaller project types. And the alternative would be that we could have some requirement that in lieu of an HOA, that at a minimum, there's some type of common maintenance agreement. Or a common wall agreement, or some type of agreement to maintain the common elements is basically what we would say.
Do we have examples of where that's worked? So if there was a common element that needed repair or replacement?
Well,
basically
anytime a townhouse gets sold, a townhouse is gonna be in an HOA or it's gonna have a common element agreement.
Yeah.
So it's like you got a townhouse and they're all painted the same color on the outside. You got a townhouse and there's a wall, firewall separating the two interior, the two interior units, or they have a common roof, for example. That common wall agreement basically, you know, specifies, you know, owner A and owner B, we're going to paint the thing every 7 years and we're going to paint it this color. We're going to split the cost like that. And if we don't agree upon the color, then we're going to paint it the color it already was. For example, that's how those things are. That's very typical in the market. Same thing with the shared driveway, for example.
Yeah.
You got four cottages and they share a driveway. That's a, that's an easier way to do it than have an HOA.
Any other comments? Commissioners?
Without exhausting all your time, I think you could probably have a language insert that says after HOA or some other acceptable common owner's agreement that may provide that alternative without, again, without, it's not just HOA, it's HOA or something. And that would allow me when I, before I got to ordinance, to allow my attorney to look through it.
I like that.
Yeah, or, the language might be, or an agreement for maintenance of common elements.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's alternative. I mean, it's not just HOA or nothing. I think, you know,
yeah.
I think yeah. I would support that.
Sounds good.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah.
All right. Anybody want to talk about the fourplex? I think makes sense to add it. Any issues or discussion?
I have a question on kind of going back to the definition, Dustin, of the cottage housing, because I missed last meeting, but the meeting before we talked about it being, it could be attached or detached, but also that it was going to be one story or one and a half story. And I thought we had agreed, or it was written down, that we were going to look at it, the idea of adjustable sizes. So you could have anywhere from 800 to 1500, but the average was going to be 1100 or whatever it turned out to be. We're going to base it on an average. I don't know where any of that went, but I feel like the cottage housing definition could work for a fourplex, depending on how it's written. And it wasn't clear in the definitions that we have here today. It didn't seem to be the same as what I remembered from two meetings ago.
It seems to me like the cottage definition was inherently detached, but I could be wrong. Dustin?
Well, and wasn't cottage just one sort of one missing middle option? And yeah, as we've touched on this before, I don't really understand why we wouldn't have fourplexes in here. I guess my only question would be, how does that affect then our definition of multifamily housing? Does that go to five and higher, or can we have that overlap in our code?
There can be overlap. You would just need to really, you know, invest. So, and that's why it shows up in the definition of what distinguishes this. So in the rest of the code, it requires multifamily. It doesn't say a size. And it says four or more units. You could establish a use type saying here's your quadplex, your missing middle quadplex. And it would be four or less units, or four units attached in a single or configuration, or a attached or detached configuration. But then what distinguishes them is these have a size restriction. So if you follow the rationale of the code, you know, a multifamily could be four units attached and they're all 2000 square feet each. This has the headroom of saying this is how you get four units in one building. They're all, you know, they're subject to the restrictions. Okay. They're oriented towards the street. They have a landscape requirement. They have this reduced parking space allowance. You know, they follow this code. So you can have two of them. It just becomes, the more units you attach to the building, to me, the larger it becomes inherently. And the design becomes more important. I mean, that's just in my recommendation and opinion. The larger the building, the more important the design. So,
One question, Dustin. So under the code as drafted, is there a possibility for someone to do two duplexes on an R3 lot? I'm going back to, you know, the Joel project on 7th. I'm imagining two of those things side by side.
Yeah, on an R3 lot, if you had that unit, they would have to be 800 square feet.
But what would that fall under if someone wanted to do something like that?
Oh, that would be two unit. So that's the two unit configuration. So
specifically in the code as contemplated, we allow two unit configurations. So yep. Now what we're really talking about is a single building with four units in it. Okay. So the 2, 3 and the 2 and 3 unit are inherently attached.
Or they could be detached. They could be detached as well. So you could do a 2 unit attached with they're attached or detached. They're both options.
And is that true in the cottage housing as well?
The cottage initially was drafted. So the cottage was drafted as detached. And then we had recommendations to allow it to be attached as well. But a lot of that changed when it became, when we lost some of the common space. So the cottage housing initially had the common cluster around the common open space. And so it started losing some of its, how it was differentiated, because there was no open space. There was no private space. There was no common space. There was no common element, you know, so it kind of lost some of its unique aspects.
So one question, Dustin, what are your thoughts if we said something radical, like the middle housing could either be 1 unit, 2 unit, 3 unit, or 4 unit buildings? So you're limiting, so you can't have a 5-plex or a 10-plex or something like that, but we just get rid of the cottage concept, and a cottage project is, you know, could be 8 1-unit buildings of middle housing.
Yeah, I think
I'm trying to figure out what the differentiator is there.
This where the ceiling came into play. So in R1, they were initially detached. If you were going to do a duplex, 2 units on one lot that could be eventually divided, it was going to be 2 unit, not 3. So that changed that. But that's kind of morphed in time. The 1 unit becomes tricky because at some point I think the idea and the way this is written is you're going to require these things as planned developments with a minimum number of units. So it's not really fit to the single unit. It's fit to here's 2 laid out, here's 3 laid out, really, and with a certain ceiling.
I guess I was expecting that you would, the way our code is organized around, or used to be organized around townhouses, was it was kind of like hierarchical. You had a townhouse building, which had a particular number of units in that building. And then above that, your townhouse project could have a certain number of townhouse buildings in it. So I'm envisioning that this middle housing could work something like that, where you've got middle housing units and they could either be 1, 2, 3, or 4 attached units. And then there's a middle housing project that has, you know, you could have 2 2-unit buildings in it, or you could have a freestanding cottage and a 2-unit building, a 3-unit building, or something like that. I'm just trying to figure out, put my head around it. What's the difference? What is the cottage housing doing here at all, I guess?
Yeah, it was just anything over 4. I mean, there was, you know, the idea of you had 2-unit configurations, 3, and there was the cottage. That was fitting when it was covering anything for 4 or more. So it allows, but again, when the common and open space went away, the cottage, it kind of lost its status, because all the open space is gone. I mean, there's nothing to common around unless somebody decides to do it, unless somebody, you know, is that that's in their design. So, the, you know, in the in its initial configuration, it had 50% of the units will face the cottage and the cluster. And now that that's all irrelevant. So it's now just back to here's how you do two units. Here's a two unit configuration or a three unit. So you could have two, three, or four and just rely on, how would you say, rely on the area requirements to find that and cap it at four. You have that option. I would clearly say where you're going to allow four, like differentiate between, are you going to allow four in R1 or, you know, that would be an important consideration.
Okay. And you can do four detached. So that does cover, you could do some combination of looking at how many units are in the, based on the square footage, right. Maximums.
Right. You can organize them as attached or detached, or you could limit that to say no more than four attached units per building too, or three. Mm-hmm. And you could break it down that way and just say no more than four in a single building and cover much of it.
Right. I, by the way, think that would be useful.
Mm-hmm. The one component that I think is, and I think Heather highlighted this, but, you know, driving all over Portland, historically, you go into some of these old neighborhoods where they have 2,500 square foot, and we have them around town, you know, or, you know, four square craftsman houses, and you go in and there's two units on the downstairs, you go upstairs, there's two units upstairs, and they fit in to those existing neighborhoods really well. So I'm a proponent that we somehow figure out how to do four. That's my vote.
But four, is it attached? What if they were all detached, popped around the site?
I think in any configuration, whether it's four little cottages or two duplexes or one thing that looks like a single family with four units in it, I think that's a valuable configuration type.
Yeah.
In particular zones. I don't know, you know, go back to your comment, Mark, is that something we should be sticking in our R1 zone? We can have that debate, but certainly in R2 and R3, I think the fours make sense.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see any argument why we wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So if there's consensus on that you would like four or less in any configuration in R2 and R3, I can work that into the code. Would you recommend staying with two or less in R1?
I would suggest that. Yep.
I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, as we said, when we look at some of these R1 neighborhoods, some of these houses that exist there are quite large. And I mean, walking by on the sidewalk, how would you know if those are broken up into a three unit or a four unit? I mean, it would look the same from the street. So I don't know that that's the distinction that we need to make for R1.
Right, what I call the clown house, I think that sold, what was that, like a five? I think that was like a five or six. Yeah, that thing could have been divided up into like four different units, so it was huge.
And it is in the R1 zone.
Which one is this?
Corner of 7th and Sherman, formerly
17th and Sherman?
7th. Right behind the Sprint building.
Oh, the clown house.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, we have several large homes in Hood River like that, and just to say that we're not really changing.
I guess the interesting thing for me is the you know, I don't know that we talk about it very much in our code, but certainly some of the code that I've written talks about, you know, one of the purposes of zoning is to maintain, you know, some light and air and privacy in your backyard. And so if you bought a one R1 house, you expect to have a house pushed to the front and some backyard. And then if we change the requirements here and all of a sudden we have wall-to-wall housing, you know, sort of deep into the lot, you know, a lot of that goes away. you know, in a smaller R2 neighborhood, some of the things I'm thinking about kind of up beyond in the area that Linda Maddox was just talking about, you know, there's not much site left to build in the backyard. There's some setbacks. But thinking in R1 neighborhoods, there's a deeper lot. And if you ended up with, you know, two houses going all the way to the back, what have we done in terms of take away that that backyard? So, I mean, I sort of like the notion of, you know, what could you tell from the front and from the street if it's one house or two? That doesn't concern me as much. But if it sort of goes back into the deep into the lot, based on some of those diagrams that Dustin was showing, that's where I get a bit concerned.
Yeah, adding to the footprint, you're saying, rather than divvying up an existing.
Yeah, I see in the example of what Commissioner Irving was just talking about, in a Portland neighborhood, you take a big house and you divide it into two or four, you know, that doesn't sound too bad, but you don't go, you know, back into the deep into the sort of the back of the lot where the trees are and where the grass is and where people have some privacy. So that's the bit that I'm concerned about.
Could I jump in and maybe I have one concept that may make this largely relevant or irrelevant. And it goes back to the concept that has been proposed a couple times, which is, should we be looking at this from a intensity of use floor area ratio versus the maximum unit area or whatever we're doing now? That, I mean, that yeah. I think would address some of what you're saying, Mark. And in R1, we expect to have this amount of use. And if there's a single big house there, that's fine. If there's a couple cottages there, that's fine. But that would limit what happens. That would prevent R1 from becoming R3.
I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think what concerns me a little bit is that, you know, what we want is more doors, as we've talked about, right? That's what we want, and we want affordability, you know, but what I'm a bit worried about is the way that this is shaping up is what we could end up with is density and sort of, you know, a lot of roofs, a lot of building, a lot of density, but there's no guarantee of the affordability or more affordability or the small size that you know comes along with that. And so it feels to me like you know, we're just sort of headed to this space where it will be about density and it won't be about affordability. And I like the idea.
Is there a risk of losing existing housing stock in favor of the middle housing? I mean, is there anything in the code about maintaining, you know, I'm trying to think of the right words, but you know, are people going to start tearing down houses left and right to do this?
Well, certainly that was one of the comments from the community, even the planning community in Portland, that would be happening.
Sorry, I'm trying to find my mute.
Yeah, no worries. No, that's a standing, I think that's a standing comment on House Bill 2001, which is that all these little bungalows will be torn down and turned into quads. I don't know if that's happened, but I don't think we can control that. Dustin, can you control that? I don't think we can control that.
No. until you start buying them, you know, this is a market. I mean, it's the market for that.
Yeah, the only mechanism I know is historic landmark denotation, and people are tearing down architecturally significant homes right now to build mansions. So I don't feel like that's something that we can have any control over.
Could we jump in and get people's opinion? I want to have, did everybody get the submission from Heather to City Council that Dustin forwarded that has a comment about how Portland tackled this with their infill code in the FAR area formula, where you get 25,000 square feet for a single, 3,000 square feet for a duplex, 3,500 square feet for 3 to 4 units, 6,000 for 4 to 6, where one or more units are affordable. Something like that, it specifically would limit stuff getting removed to build big houses, as well as incentivizes people to build more smaller things.
Yeah, I think I've been a proponent for the floor area ratio idea. I know we've batted that around a couple of times, but I think what Heather showed was useful, particularly.
Right. I definitely agree with that because it allows more flexibility, which by default means we're encouraging more middle housing.
Yeah. Everybody else? Yep. Tina.
I'm supportive of that. This is Megan.
Thanks, Megan.
Yep, I am as well. This is Erica.
And Tina?
And Tina, yes.
I think that's a yes. Okay, so Dustin, maybe take a look at the Portland FAR floor area ratio discussion.
Yeah, I guess in what direction would the FAR? So right now you have a FAR in place. We don't call it a FAR. You take your lot, you have a certain lot coverage percentage, like an R1, 40%. That's essentially a 0.4 to 1 ratio. You make that a two-story, that's 0.8 to 0.1. That's a floor ratio. Three-story, you have 1.2 to 1. That's your FAR. And then I could go down through each of the zones, you know, R2, 0.45 to 1 at one floor, 0.90 to 1 at two floors, 0.35 or 1.35 to 1, four floors. Same thing, 0.55 R3, 1.1 to 1, two-story in R3, 1.65 to 1. That's the breakdown for 1, 2, and 3-story and of FAR in the city of Hood River. We just don't call it FAR. We call it lot area coverage, and we cap the ceiling. So, I mean, that's the breakdown.
I think some of this would try and, I mean, when I'm looking at some of the pictures that you put up there, Dustin, it has basically, you just showed that 30% open space, and it showed that the little green strips are just going to be our setbacks, and then you imagine a box built out from setback to setback to maximum building height. That is an intense use, right? I think everyone would agree. And if we took an approach where we said, you know, the total usable square footage built on a lot is limited, instead of that's gonna basically lead us to inherently probably more green space. Potentially more units.
Yeah, the same thing with your code now. I mean, if you have essentially a dwelling unit size limit, you know, 1,500 with attached, 1,100 without, and you have a per unit area calculation, you'll get there as well. So for example, you have a certain number of dwelling units permitted every square footage, and you know what the size limit is. I can give you the FAR right off the top of my head. I mean, R1 at one story is 0.4, it's 0.6 at two stories, which is probably the biggest differentiating factor. R2, 0.9. Two-story, same thing with middle housing code, 4,500 square feet on a 5,000 square foot lot, 0.9. R3, 1.1 for two-story, middle housing, 1,500 square foot dwelling units, cap ceiling, 0.9. I mean, I could FAR this because you know what the ceiling is for your units. You know what the height is. You know what the ceiling and the dwelling size is. We just don't talk about it as FAR. We talk about it as here's how big your site is, here's how many units you can have.
Is there the concept of looking at the Portland formula that's shown here, that as you go larger, the units become smaller?
So that's where you have the differentiating between units between, 800, 800 and less have that higher unit, 1250 mm-hmm. square feet. The larger units are one at 1500. And once you get above that, you're off to the base code. So you have kind of now three categories of you have the standard unlimited size of your building. You follow the base code, 1500 to 800 density bonus, 800 and less density bonus beyond that. That's mm-hmm. written in the code now. So it does differentiate that.
Okay. Well, maybe we can get there, but it might be
something
we just need to see how it's written, the two versions of it.
Yeah, it was easier to understand when it was spelled out this way.
Yeah, the Portland one looked really good.
Yeah, yeah. It was a little more intuitive and, yeah.
Can you just lay ours out in a manner that is organized like that then, Dustin, so we can clearly benchmark it against something? Or benchmark it, like take our existing code and put it against this? And like you've got a bunch of tables in there that compare stuff, so seems like this would be could you do an option with this?
Oh, let me. Yeah, except you're now comparing, you don't have FAR. You don't have FAR now, so I can convert it to that. I just used your baseline code as before and after as the side-by-side.
Right, that's what I'm saying, add a third column.
So there's assumptions too of, do you take away for driveways? Do you allow a third floor? There's some tricks here. There's some loaded in assumptions that you have to kind of take it for an account. So I could do it. It's going to come loaded with assumptions.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think this Portland formula is talking about putting the driveway in there. This is purely what is this usable square foot of the building space?
Yeah. And I would be also caution FAR on a larger site. The idea that you may end up with a 10,000 square foot building with an 8,000 square foot or 10,000 square foot site with an 8,000 square foot building on it. That's the same FAR as you see now. It's just they mm-hmm. use one story that has zero impact or benefit to urban design. I mean, that's just it. I can do it. Absolutely. I will question how the sanctity of FAR as a good planning tool, but I'll do it. I won't recommend for it.
I guess the question is, Portland has a lot more money and resources than we do, and they spent years working on an infill code, and they came up with this as their preferred solution, and it seems like it overcomes a lot of hurdles here, and there's some benefits to it. So I'm trying to figure out why we wouldn't consider it.
Also, it's, I guess there's context and pushback too. They also have a movement afoot that people are setting their historic developments aside to prevent this from happening. And yeah, I would say that teardown issue is real. I mean, that's a real Portland issue that I would be concerned about, that this does become a vehicle to lose some of the character and form. And or does it become somebody's vehicle to declare their neighborhood historic and prevent this from happening there? Because that's where you've seen in Laurelhurst and other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So the pushback becomes, it's not like it's gone through with harmony. It's also why the residential infill code has changed a couple times, because there was concerns about it. So I wouldn't raise that as the standard of success. They've done it. They've used it. I think I would caution you on it. I can show you some bad FARs.
Yeah. Well, I think I was shocked at the little green strips around the site. And I think, if there's little green strips around the site and we end up with lots of little cottages with doors, then I think we've achieved a goal. But if it's not, if we end up with wall-to-wall 28 feet tall buildings, and we didn't get the small cottages or anything a little more affordable, then I think it's just going to be a tough sell to the city that we made the right compromise.
It seems like this FAR prevents that, right? One door, you got a 0.5 FAR.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like this does what we want it to do.
Okay, I think enough time's on it. Why don't we take a look at it, Dustin? And
yeah, I can break down an FAR before and after. I'll also bring you some bad FARs, though, just so you know.
Yeah. But it's more about trying to say, as it gets bigger, how do we get the unit smaller, right? More doors.
Yeah.
Okay, some other topics that came up in your highlighted areas. Anybody have an opinion on the street connectivity question? Is that kind of a mute issue, as you mentioned, because of the natural lot sizes that we're talking about? I think including it would tie it into the rest of the thought of the city, right?
Yeah, it has to do with walkable and shorter grids.
Yeah.
Street grids. That's the intent behind it. Again, as some of these infill, I would be really surprised if it was triggered because of the number of units that we're looking at. But I think it's left, or I don't think. I left it in there just in case we ended up with a scenario where we had a long stretch of units or some sort of land division where we were expecting some sort of street or pedestrian cut through to the length. I mean, that's,
I like that in there.
Do any of us disagree with?
I just had one question about something else on page 7 there, right below that, Dustin, where you talk about street frontage improvements. Why is there that clause in there that says, unless waived by the city engineer, public sidewalks and street trees shall be installed? Is that something that's in our other code? Because I think public sidewalks are important.
If there is a scenario where it's infeasible or impossible, or if there was something where, say, for example, a subsequent project was going to go through, like a district-wide project. Say, for example, on just for consideration, we were going to do something. Somebody was requesting this in the Heights, and we knew right on the tail end we could see a major streetscape and urban renewal project come through. Probably wouldn't be something we would ask them to do. $40,000-$50,000 street in front of knowing it was going to come on the heels
of the
whole project.
Okay.
I just
want to make sure we don't end up with more of these like up there by 29th where we have these little narrow streets where nothing functions. I want to make sure we're not building that kind of stuff into our code, these sub appropriate infrastructure.
Yeah, the intent is to provide at least a little flexibility where engineering is going to say not here, not appropriate, not as an apple.
Okay,
so no. Everyone's good with straight connectivity.
Yep.
Next on the list was
building
our
height.
Favorite. Sorry, go ahead.
Building height.
Go ahead.
Would you like me to bring up the some examples? Let me know if you want me to share it anytime, and I'll bring up pictures for you.
Okay, Bill, go ahead with building height.
My comment is our building height standard in Hood River has been kind of broken for a while. I think we need to go back and fix it. I looked at a lot of the diagrams, and I see the merits of being able to go to 28 feet. The residential building height in all of our residential neighborhoods used to be 35 until 10 years ago. So we got a lot of existing housing stock that's 35 feet tall. I would suggest that we don't have a different height definition and height standard for middle housing code. And we fall back on what we have for the city, and then we get around to fixing what we have at the city level to work for sloped lots and everything else.
Okay, interesting proposal. What thoughts from others? keep with the 28 feet?
Yeah, I like the 28 feet in large part because the feedback from the building community that we heard from via Heather and Greg Crafts, it's hard to build it without that. It's hard to get two stories in 25 feet. So I would support 28 feet.
Yeah, I support it as well. This is Erica. 28 feet.
Tina, Megan?
Same with me.
Yeah, I'm with Sue. The building community knows more about this, these kind of details than I do, and I think we're all sick of flat-roofed buildings, so.
All right, and that's a ditto for me, so let's move on.
Is that 28 feet measured to the flat roof, or I guess is it 28 feet? Like, this is an important distinction, because Bill mentioned just reverting to the previous city rules, which are 28 feet from grade, just does not distinguish between flat or pitched. So I just want to make sure that we're 28 feet seems to be the consensus. It's 28 feet measured how? I guess that's kind of digging into it.
I think I agree with what Bill was saying. Was we need to have the conversation we've been waiting to have around building heights. I think my thought would be is that it's the same as the rest of the city.
As soon as you get this off of our plate, let's do that.
Yeah.
And then we won't have to worry about someone building something in the interim because we'll have fixed it by the time they get to it.
And for Erica, I don't know, and for Amy, listening to the recording, now there's a piece of code that we've been waiting to get to for building heights as part of the overall municipal code updates we wanted to do. Okay, so that's that one. I think we skipped past the parking thing. I know we've spent some time on this, but do we want to do a quick round robin on zero spaces versus 0.5 versus 0.75 versus 1? Go around the horn with topic.
This is Erica. I would be in favor of, I was thinking the 0.75 or the 0.5, something that does require some parking, kind of in the middle between 0 and 1, but allows the developers some flexibility. Because I agree, especially when you get to the 4 units, you know, that we really shouldn't have to have parking for each unit.
Okay. I think Megan and Tina, we know you're at zero.
Yeah, I'm definitely at zero for an equity, climate change, and congestion issue. We have different ways of getting to it, Linda and I, but we both want less cars on our street.
Yeah, and I won't go through my whole stump speech again, but I'll just reiterate that, remember, this is just one new type of code, and we're trying to get something that we haven't gotten before. So we're not talking about changing parking requirements for the city. We're just talking about doing it for this code, and so I think we need to get out in front of it a little bit more than we've done in the past.
So I know I've been the advocate in the past of really not wanting to reduce parking at all was my original preference, because I really don't like all the on-street parking that's already happening, and this is bound to encourage so much more of it. But despite that, I agree with Tina, and you know, this is one small piece of the code. But going to zero sounds extreme to me. I would go with Erica on either 0.5 or 0.75 would be my preference, because I still think that is a huge adjustment from what we currently have.
Although keep in mind, we're not saying that it has to be zero. We're just giving developers that prerogative to say, maybe they'd rather put in, you know, a different configuration of a cottage or a building, if they didn't feel that they had this requirement. And, you know, you look at all the ways the driveways have to be configured and the turning radius and stuff. I mean, it just eats up so much of the land so quickly. I guess that's my concern. So we gave builders the maximum flexibility. Figure it out.
I'll comment. I came to this meeting thinking one seemed reasonable because it was 50% improvement on what we have now. And it seemed like it was going to be drastic. I don't think doing away with it all together makes sense for me, but I could get somewhere less than one to 0.5 or 0.75 too. I mean, I'm flexible in this, but I lean towards wanting to have something versus absolutely zero. And I don't know why I say that.
I think,
and then I guess the question would be, is if we were talking about, you know, do you round up or do you round down? You know, if you got two units and a 0.75, what do you got to build? 1.5 parking spaces or two?
Yeah. Two, it rounds up.
Yeah.
I guess my issue is just the Dana Lane example, right? That Linda Maddox mm-hmm. brings up. I mean, I just feel like, you know, I ride by that every day on my bicycle. There's no bike lane at that point in the street city. And, you know, there's a lot of cars spilling out from that little development. I mean, just an enormous amount of cars. And I'd love to say that 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, I'm going to drive by Dana Lane and it will be zero cars. I would love to see that. I'll take that bet. And I just feel like if it gets, you know, a lot more density in town, you know, all of our streets will be overflowing that way. That's my concern, right? So I wish for the best. And if we can get to zero cars, drive us as cars, pick us up, take us to the store, that sounds great. But
so it seems like
I'm concerned.
It seems like this is an area where we don't have consensus and we should maybe show our lack of consensus to council, right? We've got a couple people saying zero. Mark, are you at one?
Yep, let's go with one. Just so
you're at one. I could
turn to the scale.
You've got a couple people in the middle. So I think the communication to council as a recommendation is we are split, and these are the reasons.
I think if we had, you know, when we use examples like Sacramento and Berkeley, notwithstanding Hudson, New York, I mean, we're talking about cities with a much greater infrastructure of being able to get to the store and move around with public transportation. So that's where I get, you know, a bit hesitant. Is Hood River is this outdoor town where people are going places up to mountains and things, and, you know, just the idea that, anyway, so that's where I get a bit concerned. And it's not for the long-term view, it's just the short-term view.
I think you do have, not Bill or anyone, I think you do have six people or five that would do 0.75. And Amy represented in email that she would be agreeable to 0.75 as well, just out of.
Okay, so we picked the average. we've hit an average.
Well, I like the idea of what Bill said is representing the split to show that there is a wide opinion. And I also want to rebut a couple of Mark's comments. Mark, you haven't lived until you've seen somebody carrying a longboard by a cargo bike.
Or, oh, I've seen it. I've been to Santa Cruz. Don't worry.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen some crazy stuff on bikes. It's possible. It's just you need the constraints to make that happen. And that brings me to my like second rebuttal is if we want to see no cars, less cars on our streets, we are the people that make that happen. That it's, we are the policymakers. The entire market changes because of things that we decide. And so we can't wring our hands like this and say, but we can't take away parking because people have cars. Well, people have cars because the market hasn't been allowed to provide housing for people that don't have cars. So I would really like to show that split to city council. And we do have transit, and it's getting better every day.
Yep.
I mean, to rebut that a little bit, Megan, I mean, if you live in a place like New York City, there's a significant economic cost to having a vehicle. Here, basically, what's going to happen is if we eliminate it on site, it's going to go on street. We don't have any parking limits in any of these residential zones. We don't have parking enforcement in these residential zones. It's not like someone's going to come along and you're just going to have 30 tickets stuck to your windshield and you decide to get rid of your car. They're just going to park it on the street that's the place where I think there's a gap in your argument. I don't know. I guess maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, but it's up to us to start the discussion. We need to start talking about these issues and how and what are the unintended consequences and how we can design policy around them. Because if we don't start, then we're just never going to address it.
And I guess I'll piggyback on that, because going back to, again, the goal of this particular zoning code is to come up with a way to make housing a little more affordable. And as we walk through here, half the discussions I see are like, oh, but we got to fit in driveways. Oh, we got to fit in turning radiuses for the driveways. Oh, we got to fit in curb cuts for the driveways. It's all this like driveway, parking. And maybe people don't want that. You know, not everybody does need that. And I just think that, as Megan says, I mean, it is our job. We are the planning commission. I mean, we should be planning for, you know, alternative choices for people. And we just, as a city, we have not given people those choices yet. And I just feel that this is our opportunity to try it. And again, it's not saying that they can't go parking. We're just not saying you're required to provide parking. So I think at least we've come to the agreement that we're less than one. Okay. And I think that's a start.
Anything else on the list that people wanted to cover that we hadn't covered so far? I'm just scanning it. The only other thing was the porch.
STRs was one.
STR and porches.
And unit size, that's a significant one as well.
And that wasn't built into the FARs?
Well, I guess I could build it in FAR, but there's a ceiling on it. If you put an FAR on it's a way of getting at the FAR. Like we have a built-in cap now. Do you just want to go to FAR and take the lens off or take the unit size off?
What do people think about adding, so it was item I on page 11, maximum square foot per dwelling unit without an attached garage, 1200 square feet, units with an attached garage, maximum of 1500, including the garage. And the reason this showed up, right, Dustin, is that as we got rid of the lot coverage and went to open space maximum or minimum percentages, the feeling was it could grow, these units could grow out of scale. So we wanted to put something back in there to balance that change in the lot coverage discussion so that no one unit is greater than 1,500 square feet.
Correct. That is the... As the ceiling went up on height and the restrictions went down on the amount of area to be that could be built upon, and that went up, the potential for grossly out of scale larger units or consolidation of units into larger units went up. So that's where the unit size came from, is to put a ceiling on these what is ideally a unit that is targeted towards a smaller unit.
Yep.
A relatively more attainable unit.
Well, I agree with the idea of maximum unit size. This still seems large to me, but I think we had that discussion last week. So I definitely support having a maximum floor area.
Does anybody know what's the average on Dana Lane? Those have a garage, most of them, except poor Linda Maddox. But Bill, do you happen to know what those tend to be?
That was the picture that Greg sent. I mean,
that was something different, I think.
Those units are 12 to maybe 11 to 1400. They're basically two, there's occasional three bedrooms in there. And then Greg's comment, I think, was that I thought he said that he sent a picture of something that was on Union or somewhere like that, mm-hmm. with a little two bedroom with a garage. And he said, for some reason, that wouldn't have fit under our code. And I guess if I need to go back and look, but are we adding, calculating garage in that code language?
Yeah, that's the 1500 includes a single garage.
So
it was not.
Have you modified this since Greg sent his comment with the picture, or did that come today?
I think the 1200 came in last time. I'm having a hard time tracking when those comments came through. It's in the code. It's 1200 without an attached garage and 1500 with an attached garage. And I think it's that does have some reflection on. I think he said 1260 in his comments. If it was a 1500 square foot, you take out the garage, it was 260 square feet. So I think I just rounded to 12 and then 15. That also reflects some of the comments that are architectural consultants mentioned. It's like all the prototypes that we worked on wouldn't have been broken with a 1200 square foot size increase. And that's when we were looking at the original square footage and the amount of buildable area we were going to cap. So if we increase that amount based on those prototypes, we weren't going to break the code.
At 1200 or 1500?
1200 with without a garage and
1500. Oh, without the garage and 1500 with. Okay, yeah. I would agree with that. I know the picture that Greg sent was 1200 with an attached garage, and he said there's 850 feet of living space with two bedrooms.
Okay.
Yeah, I would cap it at 1500 with an attached garage.
Greg just sent me a text message that says his comments were related to something where we had a limit of 900 square feet. And he said that was
the cottage housing. Yeah. Right.
But that's
wondering why the cottage housing definition had 900 square feet.
But that's right.
That was a 900 square foot footprint, not size.
Okay. And so, is that still in our code set, and what section is that in? That definition, the 900 limit.
That's in definitions.
Okay.
I underlined it. It's it's underlined. It says 900 square foot footprint.
Got it. Okay. So yes. So you can't do a. So you can't do a single story with a garage then, because you could do a 1200 square foot unit or 1500 square foot if it has a garage, but we're requiring then that it be two story by this other definition or limitation.
Right, that goes back.
That's only for the cottage cluster.
What was for the, that was when cottage was more relevant.
Does it, can you check, Dustin, to see if it makes any sense for us to just strike cottage definition and fall back on the balance of the code set?
It's increasingly looking that way.
Okay.
Every meeting, it becomes less relevant.
Okay.
With probably, and I guess if that is, it'll help me do revisions if you have a 4 units or less conversation. If I have consensus there, I'll modify some of those configuration discussions based on if that is that's your R2 and R3 has 4 or less. And then I guess we kind of skip the R1. Would that be 2 or less? I think that was my mention. Or is it, mm-hmm. four or less, regardless of the zone.
Well, that's a big question, actually.
It's all down to, I mean, I think there was a consensus on R2, R3. It's all about R1. How do you want R1?
I mean, I think I'm, you know, Linda Mendez. I think I'm just worried about what a change that is without a lot of, a lot of input from the public. That's going to be a fairly sizable change to a lot of people that don't know anything about that going on.
This seems like maybe we should just take a round and take a poll. Mark, you would prefer to have it as a limit of two. Anyone else?
I would rather have it a limit of two as well. It just seems like a compatibility issue that could get very challenging.
Tina?
Oof, I'm kind of, I can see both sides of this, but I guess I also would rather err on the side of not going from 0 to 60 all at once. So yeah, I'd be okay with limiting R1.
I would be in favor of 2 with the exception of existing houses.
Oh, good point.
Could you clarify what you meant by that, Megan?
Taking the clown house and dividing it into 4 units.
Got it.
Could we word it somehow where we talk about if you're not altering the footprint, it could be more units?
Exactly.
Word is like, in the sense that we should talk about it attached or detached.
Right. That was my other exception, is if they're all detached, then... I support that.
Support what? How does that work if they're all detached?
Meaning individual houses instead of one block. Like cottage. So,
like putting a cottage, four cottage clusters on an R1?
Yes.
As long as they're small?
Yes. Something I read about in the Sacramento vote is that R1 lots were not able to, I'm going to say this wrong, they weren't able to build more square footage than what was existing prior. Mm.
Okay, I think we've heard from Sue, Tina, Mark, Megan. Erica?
Yeah, I'm in favor of limiting the R1.
Okay, Bill?
I think conceptually I'm at limiting R1. The problem is our map, and I think we're talking, you know, the house that Megan's talking about is basically adjacent to our commercial zone.
Yeah,
and it's zoned R1. I mean, we basically have a map problem there. So I think when I think about it that way, I'm okay with limiting R1. Mm-hmm. And just suggesting we should fix things like that.
Right.
So when I come back with a limit on R1, and then consider the R2 and R3, just amend the definitions on maximum number of units that can be connected.
Right, and it's tied to the square footage per the chart that you already showed, right? Of in R2, it's a certain square footage, right?
Yeah.
We keep that chart in there, right?
Yeah, I'll have to probably reconcile some things with FAR. Because it will probably throw off some, it'll throw that off.
What about adding one, two, three. What about adding that idea of more units if you're not if it is attached and you're not altering in an existing home, if you're retrofitting an existing large home?
In your code, there's a provision that's included that that's in that, and it is it is that's on right. page 16, item number 3.
So, what would if you had a house that was I'm just throwing out crazy example like a 4,000 square foot house. How many units could you get out of that?
The way it's written now is 3 max.
3.
If you had a 3,000 square foot house, you could get 3. 2,000, 3. So.
What if we up that to 4?
Yeah, I think 4 is, there's some.
We have a lot of giant houses in this town.
Yes.
That's just the way it was written before because I was capping building size across the board at 3.
Yeah. I'd be in favor of switching that to 4. And then that would kind of cover that concept of, you know, some of these big old homes.
Exactly. Without, and then I would be fine with 2 on R1s.
Is there a consensus on that?
Yeah, I think we, yep.
Or, so it's R1 or single home division. Is that regardless of zone? Or I just want to be real clear when I write this again.
Yes, it's regardless of zone.
So a Severcrop house now is eligible for a four division, just for the sake of. bring this down to kind of.
I don't think that's even feasible to put 4 kitchens in a Severcrop home, but if somebody is creative.
We have creative people.
I mean, I could see studio apartments in some of these homes that are now just, you know, giant McMansions. I mean, that's what's happened in older neighborhoods, right? You look at some of these classic fourplexes. They were once single family homes, and in the 40s or something, they were converted. So.
Right. But Dustin's point is not these classic old large homes, but the much smaller.
Right. But
homes from the 60s. Do we want that to be able to be divided into 4 units? I do struggle with that. That sounds.
I think we have to let the market be creative right now.
Yeah.
And they're not altering the scale or the character of the neighborhood. They're just adding diversity.
So if somebody had a 50s ranch and they wanted to convert it to, you know, upper and lower or 3 units, I don't see why we shouldn't allow it. It's not going to change the look from the street, essentially. It's just, again, yeah, it's allowing more flexibility.
Any sidebars on do they have to comply with anything? What's the compliance that they end up, what we end up as far as the density ratios, breakdowns, or parking? And there's the issue of, will you allow them to park all in the front yard?
Are we talking about this, still this number 3?
Yeah.
On page 2?
I'm just looking at, if there's going to be a conversion, what do we do with parking? If you're going to require it, or do you limit it?
Well, what do you have it written here for 3? As long as the dwelling can comply with building fire code and parking requirements. So. I would leave that as is.
Well, so I think are the parking requirements, they're no longer 2 parking requirements for the house that had 2 parking requirements before, but it's going to change to 0.75 for a 4 dwelling unit. Is that what you mean, Tina?
Well, I'm just reading how it's already worded. I said, I don't know that we would need to change it again. Yeah, we're talking about, yeah, taking an existing
The parking
home.
Requirements would now be overtaken by the middle, that's weird, okay. Right? You're taking an existing big ranch house that could be 4,000 square feet and you're converting it into missing middle 3 or 4 units, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're essentially carving up.
As long as the units are less than 1,200 square foot each, then you have qualified in the missing middle rule set.
And you would have 3 parking spaces provided.
Could I ask, we've had some comment, and I think that was from Greg, and I kind of said it in my notes. I mean, it does seem that some of the diagrams where we have, you know, taken the cars and driven them at some great expense to green space around the back of the units to get them out of the front setback, it seems extraordinary. And we had some comment here that parking was not permitted in any of those spaces. However, in our current code set, I think up to 50% of the parking can be met within the front yard setback. Is that right, Dustin?
That's correct.
I mean, I don't know why we wouldn't just maintain that position. I'll throw it out there as a devil's advocate. Why don't we just leave it the way it is? 50% of the parking can be in the front yard setback. That in this case where we have an existing conversion, the rules apply.
But you're
I struggle this one too, because I understand the concept of not having the front yard full of cars, but on the other hand, you end up with a heck of a lot more driveway. So I don't know. I guess I also think it's kind of a funny dichotomy where everybody wants their cars, but then we don't want to look at them. I mean, either we love our cars or we don't love our cars. I can't quite figure out what the mentality is on that. I personally don't have a problem with cars parked in the street or in a driveway. I think that's perfectly good use of pavement. So I don't really understand that putting them in the back idea. So I'm with you, Bill. I'll be devil's advocate with you.
Yeah, I'm fine with that too. I think that converting housing, like there's some big houses that are for sale right now that would be great to be able to convert over to 4 units.
Other thoughts, input?
I don't understand where that ended up. Did we say that we want to leave the parking at 0.75? Per unit for whatever number of units existing dwelling turned into.
That applies. That's a new missing middle formula for parking. Okay. But the question is just, do we, a lot of this is saying we want the house pushed towards the street and the parking at the back.
Yeah.
Is the question.
Yeah.
I think I took it as the conversion would allow 50% of the required parking to be in the front yard, as the current code allows.
That sounds good. So is that saying that even though it's converted to a missing middle, there's a special grandfathering in of the front driveway parking situation? Well,
that's just what I heard. That's just what I heard come out of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I heard that too.
That would be a special exception.
But I think Bill was saying he wanted to extend that to all of the missing middle housing, and Tina was too, so that we don't need to
bigger question. It's
pave over all the way to the back in all of these missing middle housing where they're going to have some parking.
Like as Greg had pointed out in his letter, I mean, the Katie's Lane development, you know, a lot of those homes there have that lovely little creek running through the back, and they wouldn't have been able to do that development if they had to put all the parking in the back. And, you know, I have friends that live in that development, and yeah, the cars are in the front when you drive in there, or walk in there or whatever. But then, you know, a lot of people have nice little patios or whatever in the back, and it works out really nicely, I think. So we're saying that you can't do that anymore. And I'm not sure that's a wise choice. I understand the concept of the community, you know, the pretty front yards, but on the other hand, I'm just not sure it's practical.
What about if, so the instead of saying all or none, we can go to our existing code, which says, again, 50% of it can be in it. That's, if you can imagine, if you've got some street frontage or this happening and only 50% of it is allowed, you're still going to have a, in my mind, a significant amount of the streetscape that is not cars parked.
I think wasn't the other issue we were trying to solve is just not having all this curb cut. And so when you get to have 2 or 3, 4 units, you would end up with a lot of curb cut for all of that direct access as opposed to taking it to the back. I thought that's the problem we were trying to solve.
See, if we eliminate the parking, the developers have to solve this problem.
Right. and one thing in favor of doing front is it is way less infrastructure to install, and whether state of Oregon or we surpass the 10,000 population or state of Oregon votes to eliminate parking or other market forces like gas prices or whatever comes down, this allows homeowners to really easily do the opposite of pave over paradise, tear up their driveways.
Pretty soon we'll just have landing pads on our roofs.
Jetpacks on our back.
Okay.
What, one last topic, STR?
No STRs.
Oh, sorry. Is there a consensus you want to go back to 50% in the front? Across the board on all these?
I don't know that we have consensus on that, no. I'm not sure.
I felt like there was more consensus on the conversion than there was discussion on this. Am I changing anything?
I think I don't necessarily, I'm not a great fan of making a requirement that requires, a lot more of this coverage of the green space. I think my issue is when I think of missing middle and certainly the cottage housing that we looked at before it was eliminated, there's this idea that this is the type and scale of development, the product that, does bring it to the street, and that you end up with neighborhoods that are more connected to the people around it. So when we started this conversation, it just felt right that, that was the sort of smaller unit and the cars were hidden around the back, and we would pull people out towards the street, had the common spaces and the walkways. So if we're moving towards, sort of your duplex, triplex, quadplex model, I think in my mind it works better for duplexes, but when you get a quad, and then I have some concerns about parking in the front. I can imagine how that could look.
50%.
Yeah, I'm supportive of 50% across the board.
So that's 50% of the 0.75 that would be required.
Could be in the setback. The rest of it has to be out of the setback.
Yeah.
So for 3-4 units, you're going to end up with 3 spaces.
3 spaces.
1.5 in the setback. So 30 feet of your front yard is now driveway.
Or what about if we round down?
So now you got one driveway car in the front, and hopefully, and then you take out one on-street parking space, and now you have no more parking, and you got a bunch of sidewalk in the front yard. You guys can do the math. There's a real reason why I crafted it that way. So, and 30% of your setback and landscape space is now parking lot. We went down this with Wasco. We can do a field trip one day.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, and I think the 0.75 parking requirement is not really going to decrease the number of cars for the next 30 years or so. I think it's just going to push more cars out into the street. So we've got more cars in the street and we have frontage parking added to it. That does not sound too appealing.
All right, can we put this in the column of wide-ranging opinions? Can we pun on that one?
Big irritants.
STRs, can we finish on on a high note here?
So let me throw my piece out there. I mean, you guys probably know my historical opinion on STRs, and we've got to a point where we have a code set that I think we know how to enforce. The problem I have from us, and it's really easy for me as a real estate agent, when someone calls me up and says, hey, can you do STRs? And I say, you know, here's the answer. It's very cut and dry. C1, C2 zone, yes. R1 through R3, no, unless it's your primary residence, and then you can do it up to a maximum of 90 days and you have to be blah, 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 blah. So I can't imagine how the world would work if it were something other than that. And every single property, whenever it was sold, you had to determine whether it could or could not, and there was some exception to it. So I feel like the code set that we have in place puts the amount of control we needed over things. And adding that particular language into this code makes it really confusing.
So if you have a 4-unit cottage cluster, a detached house or all together in one, and you buy one of the units, can you STR out the other three? Or are they sold as separate units and that's not your primary residence and doesn't count?
I think we have to look at it on a dwelling unit perspective. I mean, that's what our code does.
But the STR thing is that it's listed as your primary residence. If the whole building is your primary residence, you just happen to be renting out three of the units.
That doesn't work like that, right?
Okay.
That's fine then. They're addressed differently. It's a different dwelling unit. I mean, I'm not envisioning that someone does that, but I'm envisioning someone, we got four cottages and someone lives in one of those as a primary and they travel for 2 months of the summer or something and they should be allowed to do it. And I just can't imagine how complicated it would be in the other world.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to afford our mortgage if we couldn't rent out our spare bedroom. And the 90 days a year is super easy to comply with. I think I hit 24 days last year. And I don't agree with, we can't do SDRs for non-owner occupied. So I don't understand what the problem would be if it was the owner was living there.
Would part of it is how requirements for parking. So it's one space for two bedrooms. So if you have more than that, do you allow them to share their neighbor's parking? If I have 0.75 spaces per unit and the whole development has 5 parking spaces, just for example, across the board, who gets first right of those if they're common?
Who buys them?
I think that's the reality of it, is that when we talk about this 0.75, when you either go to sell a unit or you go to lease a unit, it's not going to be like, oh, by the way, it's first come, first serve. It's going to be like, this is your reserve parking and you own it and you can use it or it's not. That's my experience as a landlord, is just tell everybody park in your space, not in everybody else's.
I will just need to assign parking for these licenses.
Yeah.
the STR license.
I am strongly anti short-term rental on this. I understand your point, Bill, that, you know, it kind of adds another layer of code, but it's right here. It's right here in the 1725 that you can't do it. My feeling is that we've already increased density. We're putting people in smaller areas living together, and now you're going to let people turn it into someone's vacation crash pad. I just think that's so intrusive for the other people in those homes. These are supposed to be homes for residents. They shouldn't become vacation party zones, and that's exactly what they're going to become. I think it's a terrible idea.
I hear your concern. I'm trying to think, like, when I hear you talking, the concept I hear is that this is a second homeowner from Portland who's using this and renting it out all the time. That you can't do that. So
right. To get the people who, you know, go live in their van for 3 months so they can make bank on their Hood River house, which is what happens on my street and all summer long. Okay.
Right.
In my neighborhood. And it's someone who's their primary home. And it's what happens.
But you can't do that, can you?
Yeah, if it's their primary home, they can. It's their primary address. They take their van and go camping somewhere, and they rent their house out to all summer long.
Yeah, a three-month rental isn't a short-term rental.
Yeah. This is supposed to be people who are trying to buy a home.
If it's my
profit on, you know, I don't know. I just think short-term rentals destroy communities so badly, and now we're trying to create, you know, we're trying to create homes for people, and that is not what short-term rentals do. They don't create community or homes for people.
I'm just trying to figure out how to keep it so that people understand the regulation that is in place and what it is. That's where I'm stuck.
Yeah, I understand that it makes it a little more complicated in the code, but if it's written right into the code...
I think I go along with Tina in that the whole reason we're introducing this new code, this missing middle, is, I mean, right now people can buy short-term, I mean, they can, you know, we can, people can go and find a short-term rental type of situation, right, under the new rules. But if we're going to bring back this missing middle, to me, it feels kind of purposeful that is the goal here, and to sort of bring a whole bunch of houses, infill a bunch of neighborhoods, again, sort of in the idea of, you know, there's a compromise that we're making, right, in terms of we're giving up some air and some light and some grass, and we're basically saying we can have density. And what we want out of it is the missing middle for the local workers to be able to work and walk to their place of employment downtown or wherever, right? That's the missing part of the missing middle. And if we create a whole bunch of short-term rentals, that didn't help what we're trying to do. I think that's my feeling.
And you want to talk about blood from the rest of the city, man.
Yeah, again, like you said,
I said to talk about blowback from the rest of our city. I mean, as you said, we're asking people to kind of say, okay, this is going to be denser than you're used to. There's going to be more people in these neighborhoods than we're all used to. And now when summer comes, you know, a chunk of them are going to be vacation rentals. That just sounds like a, you know, recipe for disaster.
No, but
I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm just trying to figure out how we manage it and track it and communicate it. And I'm just thinking if someone buys one of these things, or then someone goes to just the short-term rental application process. I mean, do you see any concern here administering this, Dustin, when someone goes to apply for one, a short-term rental? And
yeah, that it would have to be caught that all of a sudden if they showed up and it was their primary residence, it was in the right zone, and they had two parking spaces or a parking space assigned to it, we would have to have some trigger to say what. We just have to be mindful that it was permitted under this code. It presents a challenge that they could slip through, because what differentiates, once it's done, approved, built, lived in, you know, it has all the makings of a regular house to some extent, right, minus this provision. I mean, it just becomes a little tricky.
Do we call the zone something different then? Instead of just like R1, R2, R3, is it like RM1 or something to signify?
No, the house needs a label. The group of houses, yeah, needs a label off the street. Welcome to Missing Middle. Sue, Erica?
I really don't understand the difference between me having a roommate, which I have like 6 months of the year, and me having a guest who's not, I would say the majority of people that do hosted home share SDRs are not looking for people who are going to party. They're looking for people that are there to get recommendations from them on how to be a better tourist.
Well, hosted home share is different than vacation rental. So yes, if you're living, you have a roommate, that's, I don't think anybody's questioning that.
Okay, but that's an STR. That's what I'm...
By the city, is lumped into the same, right?
Right. And no, so
someone living with you is
I take issue with grouping vacation rentals.
So I think one of the goals when people do STRs is to get the income from that, right? That's a primary reason people do that. And one of the things that I think changed last meeting, and again, I wasn't there, but we decided not to allow ADUs on missing middle housing. And I'm not sure how.
That's another issue I think we need to talk about.
Because Greg mentioned that too, and I kind of wondered, like, why would we not allow ADUs? Because it allows people to get income and therefore afford to buy a home. Although I wondered if that was really how it worked, because it simultaneously makes the home that you're building more expensive and makes it harder for people to get into, right? So I'm not sure what's cause and effect there. But as opposed to STRs, if we allowed ADUs, there's an opportunity for people to have a venue for having additional income should they want that from their primary residence.
The code, you know, like the ADU code, would allow you to build a large unit and a small unit on one lot. I mean, just like you do today. It's just that we calculate them. The other issue becomes, as these things are built as planned unit developments in some way, although not through the PUD process, they're a small configuration of lots with shared access, with shared facilities, the units can get built in. I mean, that's part of the accessory dwelling. So there's nothing to prevent you from building and having two units on one lot in this, whether they're big or small. It just, what it stops is having two units on one lot and then having a third ADU also being considered on there, and without consideration of density. Right now, the ADUs are also permitted. We have a land use approval for them. It's a limited land use approval. It doesn't require a hearing, but that helps us track and trigger the STR regulations, because we have a record of them, you know, a special record for each ADU that goes through. They're also given some deference for utility hookups and connections, and they're intentionally small. I mean, so it becomes a little tricky, as we kind of have captured the opportunity for someone to do an ADU. It's just, we call it a unit, a small unit that can be on your lot, or actually you can build it similar sized unit and have its own lot. I mean, I think it's built into the flexibility of the code. It's just, we just don't refer to it as
an ADU. So. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense to me now. I didn't really understand why.
Okay, so given that opportunity exists, I guess I'm more in concurrence that we may not need the option to allow STRs, short-term rentals, in these units. Because I do kind of agree with Tina on this. I just don't know how you administer it. That's the challenge.
Yeah,
You keeping track here, Dustin?
Yeah. I don't really have full STR. I have three. I have a count of three on this one. So hasn't really crossed the threshold, but I knew it had to be something that had to be discussed in the code. Either
I thought we were all in agreement. We just don't know how you're going to administer it.
No, I don't think we're in agreement, right? So I think Tina, no. Sue, Mark are saying no STRs. I think Megan, Bill are saying STRs. And Erica could either tie us or
I'm
us
here. I'm tipping us over into the no zone.
Okay, that's no four is a majority.
And we're going to all show up at the hearing for Megan to find out why hosted home share is lumped into the STR world.
Hosted home share versus vacation rental. They're all STRs. That's the.
Yeah, right.
Yes, okay. I don't get it. And a lot of people afford their homes that way.
Yep. Okay, is that the entire list, or is there anything else that somebody wants to bring up on the list?
One thing that kind of got left in the dust that I think I'll just do is the definition of what is landscape, the definition of what is middle housing. Those back to, I think those are important items.
Yep. Do I want to raise the front porch?
No. let's we're gonna have to see this code again, so I think, and Dustin's making a lot of changes, and I'm gonna make a motion that I've hit my limit.
Okay, can we make a motion to make a can we make a motion to cover the meeting minutes next time?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, unless somebody is just, is there any changes to it? Does anyone have any recommended changes? If it's going to be an exhaustive discussion, we could just you could take a motion now.
Yes.
A discussion.
I just skim them. I can make a motion that we pass them.
Okay, go ahead.
I make a motion that we pass the minutes as presented. So do I need to read the dates off my computer? Went to
I
sleep.
Think you're good. There's a whole bunch of dates. Do we have a second?
I second that.
All right. So we have a motion to approve the meeting minutes from the ones in the bundle. By Tina and seconded by Megan. All in favor? Oh, any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Minutes are done. Okay. So thanks, Dustin. We will look for your update based on tonight's comments. Let us know what you want to do with the date 2 weeks out.
That would be the Tuesday, the 9th. I may have a conflict because I live my life around Monday nights. So let me work on that. We should continue to a date certain since the hearing is open.
So that would be, we're talking about Tuesday, the 16th of February.
And we would.
I will definitely be gone on the 16th.
Okay, so we're definitely not meeting that week.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm looking for my my life a week out. Sixteen works for me.
Okay, so everyone ready to come back on the 16th and continue, close out this discussion?
Okay.
Yes.
Yep.
Close it out. I like it. I'll bring you back an FAR analysis, kind of some discussions, and we'll and the revisions based on this.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you all for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good evening. Yeah. Bye.